This talk was recorded at Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society in Los Angeles and is freely offered for your enjoyment. For more information, please visit againstthestream.org.
You ever have that thought? Like, maybe he fell asleep. This has been way more than 30 minutes, I'm sure of it. He's just fucking with us. He's trying to make us sit longer, checking your watch. One time we were on retreat and somebody actually got up off of their chair and came up and rang the bell. And because he was convinced that we were meditating longer than we were supposed to. I wanted to talk a little bit tonight about perseverance and the long-term commitment that it takes to really benefit, to deeply benefit, to actually have the kind of transformation that the Buddha was talking about, that Buddhism offers as a really a long path of practice. And the dedication and perseverance that is necessary to truly make the changes, to really train our mind and our heart to be mindful, to be kind, to be compassionate, forgiving, loving, generous. That it's really a long-term process that we have to be steadfast in our engagement and persevere for years. A couple weeks ago, I talked about how the Buddha had said only a handful of people in each generation will really follow this path. And I had made the analogy with outlaw biker culture of 1%. That perhaps only 1% of people who start the path will actually persevere. A couple of different ways that I want to talk about this, and maybe an analogy or two. The first one that comes to mind is this image that I think is used often about a spiritual quest as a journey. As a journey that kind of has a beginning and perhaps has an end. That it is a path that we walk. It is a trek that we are going to undertake. And we say, okay, I'm going to start here, and the beginning is suffering. I'm going to start right here in my suffering, and I'm going to start with my making baby steps towards the goal, which is not suffering, happiness, freedom from suffering. Since you're here, you've started. Some of you have been coming and practicing and on a spiritual path in a very sincere way, persevering for years. Some of you, it's more new. I was thinking about often the spiritual quest is like to the top of the mountain, right? The top of the mountain is where freedom lies. How many people have hiked to the Hollywood sign? It depends on which way you go up there. Like if you start in Runyon Canyon or even in Griffith Park, there's some really steep parts in the beginning, usually. There's some switchbacks, but usually there's some kind of like real hard work to do in the beginning of that hike. You have to go from the flatland up. But then, and it's hard, and in the beginning of a spiritual quest, a meditative life, often it's tough. But then you get up a little ways, and it flattens out, and you get onto the fire road, and it starts kind of like, oh, this ain't so bad, if you even make it that far. Right? Some people, even just in that little hike, get sort of halfway up the canyon and say, no way, I'm not doing this. I don't want to see that stupid sign. Can't we drive up there? But if you even make it to that part, you can kind of get through that first effort and then you see, and you turn around and you see, oh, there's a view. Oh, this is cool and it's flat and I can just take it a little bit easy and walk and switch backs. And then just before you get to towards the bottom of the sign, then there's another really sort of hard, steep part. And I think that meditation, awakening, training the heart and mind is a bit like that. There's these periods where it's really, really heavy lifting, hard trudging. And there's periods where it's like, oh no, this isn't so bad, and I'm enjoying the fruits of having hiked up that first section, and now I get a view and I feel sort of satisfied and happy. And but before long, nope, there's another hard climb ahead. And you finally, you get all the way up there to the Hollywood sign and you say, I made it. I'm here. Where's the prizes? Or, you know, now what? And there's some feeling of, okay, I made it this far and there's a pretty good view. I sort of look down and I say, wow, look at all that fucking smog. I've been living in that smog. This is disgusting. I breathe this. I'm up above it a little bit. I get a perspective. I didn't even know how filthy the air was until I got out of it a little bit. And then if you're up there, maybe not right at the sign, but if you go all the way to the top, if you turn around, you're like, so you're looking out over Hollywood and maybe even see the ocean, and if you can see through the smog, you could see Santa Monica and clear day. But then if you turn around, you see the valley and you see Mount Angeles. And you realize, I'm not at the top of the mountain at all. Angeles, like this is just a little hill. I thought I was here, damn it. I thought I was enlightened and here I am just on this little tiny hill. There's this valley I gotta go back through and I gotta go all the way up to 10,000 feet. Angeles Crest, probably not that high. 5,000 feet, whatever it is. So, thinking of the practice of the different levels of climbing and getting a view and then getting to where I thought I was at the top and then, oh no, now I gotta go back down and go back through this valley and up this whole other. And if you persevere and you do that and you get all the way to the top of Angeles Crest, and then you'll see the Sierras in the distance. And you say, oh wow, there's still all of this. I gotta go up the Sierras. I gotta go climb Half Dome. And then you go and you do that and you get to the Sierras and you see the Rocky Mountains. I'm still only at 7,000 feet and there's a 15,000 foot. And you persevere, if you persevere, and you get to the top of the Rocky Mountains and in the distance you see the Himalayas. And how often do those who start the journey say, hey, I'm just going to build a house up here in the Hollywood Hills. This is good enough for me. You know, or that wasn't good, but then you got over there and you got over to La Cañada or, you know, somewhere at the base of Angeles Crest or got up into the Rocky Mountains and said, you know, mile high, I'm cool. This is far enough for me. And I propose that most of us that start the quest, start the journey, start the practice of going inward, of taking this journey, give up before we actually reach the goal. And I'm not talking about magical enlightenment goal. I'm talking about happiness. Before we actually get to the place where we forgive ourselves completely, everyone else completely, before we get to the place where we can meet our pain with compassion, we say, I'm just going to take another drink. I'm going to give up. Because this sitting with pain business is too difficult. This journey is too arduous. And often we lose hope. People lose hope. Feel like, man, I already got this mountain and that mountain, and there's more? Does it ever end? Of course, there's the hope, there's the promise, there's the Buddha who says, yes, there is an end to this journey. If we continue to walk this eightfold path, we will have an understanding of the way that it is that is in harmony with reality. We will have intentional living, right action, right speech, right livelihood, effort, mindfulness, concentration, that this path will lead to the end of suffering. But it is one that each individual has to walk completely for themselves, and it is going to be one where there is going to be really steep ravines to climb and dark forests to go through and beautiful views at times. But to not get complacent and to not give up just because there's that feeling of like, well, I'm suffering so much less than I used to. I've really reduced the amount of stress in my life. I'm not actually happy, but I'm not as miserable as I was. And maybe this is all I deserve or all I get. And so part of my question here is, how do we persevere even when we don't want to? So we're not so motivated anymore, right? The suffering that begins our journey hopefully will be alleviated long before the goal of true ease and well-being is reached. And without that great suffering that gets us on the cushion in the beginning, how do we persevere? How do we not build our home in one of the places where it's like, ah, the view's pretty nice from here. It's okay. With the honestly knowing in our heart of hearts that I'm not finished. I'm not really happy. I'm not using my life's energy to its full potential. But it's not as bad as it used to be. So I was thinking about the 1% again. From this seat up here, it's always pretty obvious to me that our room is always about this full, sometimes a little bit more full, sometimes a little less. There's always between 50 and 100 people at class every week, twice a week. But there's always 6 to 15 new people, which means that there's 15 people who aren't coming back. There's always about the same amount of people in our community. There's always a whole bunch of new people who aren't coming back. I mean, who are coming for the first time. I've been teaching in Los Angeles for about 5 years now. How many people came to when I was teaching at Golden Bridge? Wow. I'm a shitty teacher. And you know, I'm just saying because, I could take full responsibility for people walking out of my class, Jordan. One 1%. You guys have a good night. Yeah. But for the sake of this perspective, of saying that, okay, let's not say that I'm an awful teacher. Let's say that people just don't follow through. One of the main commitments in Buddhism is a taking refuge in your community. It is finding a community that you like and attending that community regularly as part of your spiritual practice, being involved with a weekly meditation group. If all of the people who had attended our class came, we would need Dodger Stadium. We would have 10,000 people meditating tonight together, if everyone who'd come through my classes in the last 5 years in LA came and followed through, and not just the ones who are spiritual tourists. I like that term. Some of us are just spiritual tourists, and I was that for a long time, and I would check out the Sufis, and I would check out the Buddhists, and I would check out the Hare Krishnas and Golden Bridge, and, you know, I would check them all out, and I was really just checking them out. But at some point, I committed and knew for me, Buddhism was the path I wanted to follow. And I would imagine that thousands of people, and that many of you in this room aren't just checking it out, but have a knowing in your heart that the Dharma, the Buddha's Dharma, speaks to you, and it is a path you want to follow. But even out of those people, even out of those of us who've said, I really want to follow this path, persevering is rare. Showing up to the community is rare. Getting your ass on the cushion on a daily basis is even more rare. And I don't say this to be a bummer. Of course, I say this to try to inspire you and encourage you to make a deep commitment to your practice. To take refuge in your practice. To say, I want to persevere even when I don't feel like it later, knowing that you're going to get to the place on the journey where you don't feel like it anymore. The Buddha spoke of the rolling up the mat stage, where you say, I'm rolling up my meditation cushion and going to the beach. I'm building a house. This is far enough. I don't want to do this work anymore. I don't want to face my attachments, my delusions, my cravings. It's like the other analogy, sometimes the path, the matrix. It's like we've popped out of the matrix of living in this life of an illusion, and we see, oh, there's another reality. Happiness actually is possible. I don't have to suffer so much. But that at some point, there is the temptation to plug back in. For all of us, there will be the temptation to say, you know, maybe ignorance is bliss. Life seemed easier when I was not paying such close attention. Perhaps I will go back to sleep. One of the other ways that I've thought about this quite a bit is, and the Buddha at some point talked about finding the Dharma and discovering the potential of liberation is like finding an ancient city. An ancient city that has been overgrown by the forest has reclaimed it and has basically been buried beneath the hundreds or thousands of years of sediment. And that the practice is like excavating. It's like an archaeological dig. My experience with trying to dig, trying to uncover some freedom from within myself, has been that mindfulness proved to be a relief in the beginning. In the other analogy, I said, okay, sometimes there's the steep part in the beginning. Sometimes there's the pink cloud in the beginning, where it's like, oh, no, this isn't so hard. I pay attention to my breath. I don't have to think about the future, which is where suffering is. I don't have to think about the past, which is where suffering is. Present moment, mindfulness, relief. Not so much suffering if I can just not think about the future and the past. If I can just be in the present moment, what a relief. What a joy to not be in the hell I create for myself in the future or the hell that I lived through in the past. So that first layer of digging for me, when I started mindfulness, I saw this is a great tool. But that as a, and maybe mindfulness is the sort of shovel, right, of the dig. As I started shoveling, and as we start shoveling, start uncovering the skeletons. Mindfulness, first a relief, and then it starts to show us how attached we are. How angry we are, how afraid we are. How much craving and attachment is ruling our lives. And brings us into that matrix-like experience of, like, oh, do I really want to pay such close attention to my crazy mind? As one meditation teacher said, you know, meditation is one insult after another. It's a constant barrage of bad news. I'm attached, I'm angry, I'm afraid. I'm attached, I'm angry, I'm afraid. In this excavation. And I could say, really, it's our heart that we are trying to uncover. It's one way to talk about it. And in order to get to the core of our heart, the forgotten core of who we are, to get to the good stuff, the kindness and the love and the compassion and the true wisdom, we have to uncover all of the resentments that are blocking the compassion. We have to uncover and face all of the hatred, all of the fear, all of the low self-esteem. There's no way around our conditioning. We have to dig it all up. And it really does feel, it's like, man, I was going for buried treasure, and I have to dig through this graveyard of my life first. All of the pain that I've ever experienced is still here, covering my heart. And mindfulness doesn't let me go around. I have to go right through it. Each spoonful, each shovelful, each toothpickful. So, of course, people say, this is hard work. I don't know if I want to really do this. I don't want to persevere. I don't think I'll roll up my mat. Do I really want to continue this journey that is making me face all of the pain of my life in order to end the suffering? Isn't there an easier way? Isn't there a way that's just bliss and happiness all of the time? Pretty sure that all of the other religions offer a much easier path. This Buddhist shit, it's all about facing yourself. I don't want to be me. Why would I want to face me? Pure perseverance is rare. And it takes such great courage. Such great courage to say, I'm going to start and continue this excavation of myself, of my heart, of my mind, of my Buddha nature. No matter how painful it gets, no matter how insistent my mind becomes that it's not safe, or that my heart becomes that it's, because those dark night of the soul type experiences will happen eventually. And I'm not even sure if that's why people don't persevere. I know that sometimes people hit that wall. Maybe you've had some experiences in your life where you start to feel like I'm just hitting a wall. I think the other piece around the difficulty of persevering is that it's so counter to not only our built-in survival instinct, which says don't face your pain, avoid it, which says don't let go of pleasure, cling to it, and crave for it. Right? We're being asked to do the opposite of what our body naturally is wired to do. The survival instinct and happiness are at odds. Do you get this? I hope you get this. Please, Miles.
Where, if in meditation, you're concentrating on whatever, whether it's a breath, on mandala, whatever, you're concentrating, you know, really fixated on like present time awareness, where does the confrontation with all of the crap take place? Because part of me gets this vibe that it's supposed to take place in meditation, and yet part of me gets this vibe that, well, in a way, like, nothing's supposed to take place in meditation. And it seems like, for me, I mean, I know where the confrontation takes place for me, and that's in life. And when I try to bring mindfulness to my reactions in a specific situation, that, you know, I'm not sure that's right, you know.
I think it's right. The only piece that I might clarify is that in meditation, there are several different techniques. One is the kind of concentration that I think you're talking about, where it's single-pointed and everything else is ignored. That is useful to gather the attention. That's the breath awareness. But as you hear me every week say, from that concentration on the breath, expand to everything, including your emotions, your mind, your moods, what's present for you, in your whole being. And that's where the confrontation takes place. Where you realize what's really happening for me right now is that my heart is filled with anger. And I'm stuck in this resentment. And the appropriate, skillful means, I know, is forgiveness. And so mindfulness brought me into contact with my resentment. Now I'm going to shift towards forgiveness meditation. I don't have to stick with the breath. The breath got me to where I needed to be, which was in contact with my rage. And now I need to approach my rage with mercy, with forgiveness, with care. And so then so then it does really take place right here on the cushion. And, of course, our meditative life is not only to be done on the cushion, it's to be done in our relationships, at work, on the freeway, you know, hiking, wherever we are. But the formal practice, the sitting practice, is the training ground so that we become more and more skillful with applying the appropriate antidote to whatever happens to be causing suffering right now. It's resentment, forgiveness. It's clinging, non-attachment. It's craving, let go. It's pain, compassion. It's selfishness, generosity. It's jealousness, appreciative joy, right? So we get this toolbox. And then we have the appropriate response to every form of suffering to be applied in the present moment, whatever we're doing. Please.
Yeah, if I may, I'm pretty new to meditation, but like that all, when you were like, it's you, we're going to get to let go of all this, I was like, oh, great, we're going to get to let go. And then as you brought each up, it was like you came crashing down. But then slowly as I like got from one to the next, it was the ones behind had just gone until I got to a point where it was kind of like I had let go of it just by actually thinking about it and then moving forward. So, yeah, I feel like since I'm new, like the confrontation happened without me being able to stop it. So.
And it's totally what I'm talking about is that this is a long-term skill-building process. If we persevere, we will be able to walk through and let go of and meet with the appropriate response everything that happens in life. There will be no unworkable, unbearable causes of suffering anymore. It'll just be, okay, this hurts, compassion. Oh, okay, I'm triggered, forgiveness. Okay, I'm afraid, acceptance of fear in my body, some confidence, impermanence. But that in this digging, there's going to be the temptation to stop short. And let me just finish my other thought, which was that I think that a lot of it isn't even that people hit the wall, but just that it's so counter to this world. Is the whole world is promising you will be happy if you get enough stuff. You'll be happy if you get enough money, if you get enough sex, if you get enough. There's this pervasive false hope out here in the material world that says you don't have to really do the hard internal work. Just get enough circumstances to line up and you'll be happy. The right relationship, the right job, right amount of savings, right amount of pleasure, right six-pack abs, buns of steel, you will be happy. And so that's, I mean, so it's not only we hit the wall, it's, that just sounds better than sitting still. I'll dedicate my life's energy to buns of steel. This meditation stuff, it's hard. Please.
But isn't that true even of the meditation experience, that we have an idea that if we were really, when we start, that when if we were really good at this meditating, that we'd be able to sit for hours and never have a thought go through our mind. And in the end, or along the way somewhere, we realize we didn't let it go. We just recognize when we sit down, these thoughts are going to come and go.
Yeah.
And I'm not going to pay them, and I'm not going to give them any power. Mm-hmm. You know, but as long as we cling to the thought that, oh my God, I shouldn't be thinking about this. This shouldn't be happening to me. Mm-hmm. Then it's disruptive. But when you let it go, then it is what it is.
Yeah. Yeah. I agree with you. I think that what you're saying is right on. As long as we're paying some attention to the content, we don't want to just ignore our minds, like you're saying. We're not going to stop them, and we're not going to always ignore them. Some of what's happening in our heart and our mind is really important information for us to have. I don't think that this is what you're saying at all, but I want to acknowledge that we can misuse meditation as an avoidance tool. Rather than, I'm angry, I need to forgive, we can use, I'm angry, let me pay attention to my breath. Let me let go of that thought. Rather than acknowledging, no, I'm really angry, I need to have some tenderness for the suffering of this anger, and I need to do some forgiveness for it. I don't want to just ignore the fact that I'm angry, I want to respond to it. Please, did you still...
Well, you said what I was going to say, just that it's kind of like, I feel like Jack and Beanstalk trying to go to the market with the goat, but everybody's like, come over here. And there's so many distractions, and it's just easier to fall into the kind of pizza in a movie as opposed to meditating. But also, my boyfriend teaches Tai Chi, and he lives in Hong Kong. And he feels much better when he teaches Tai Chi. It makes him less moody. Life is good with the Tai Chi. It's his meditation. And he said, on the streets, in the parks, everywhere at all times, tons of people are doing Tai Chi. And he said, so just anytime he could just go join in. And they'd be like, hey, and he could do it with them. And so he kind of had like a community for a week. Mm-hmm. And I think that's the other thing that's really hard. We have this place. But then when I go home in my life and my world, there really isn't anybody else.
Yeah.
And it's kind of hard, you know.
It's really hard, and it's definitely why community is so important. And to make connections with like-minded people.
Yeah.
And the Buddha talked about the company of the wise. And, you know, this is, you know, there's a lot of wise people, but for tonight, this is our crew. Sort of a motley crew, but this is, you know, 70 people in Los Angeles who care about mindfulness, who have the intention to be generous, to be kind, to be forgiving. And you need to know each other, because there's, you know, another 7 million people out there that don't give a shit. And I'm not saying that it's us and them. I'm not saying that. But I am acknowledging that it is rare to really care and to be really committed to practice.
So what do you do when, and this is a very rare occurrence for me, but when you have that anger where your heart is beating and you're, you know, whether it was a confrontation with someone or just a really bad day, and your old go-tos were whatever vices you had, which you're not engaging in any longer, and you just cannot get your ass on the cushion because it's that raw energy that you just want to go beat on something with a baseball bat. And there, you've got to release that valve. You have to let it out somehow. And, you know, I'm a girl, so sometimes crying, that helps. But, I mean, it really doesn't. Sometimes I can't even get myself to cry because I'm just so angry at whatever happened or the situation that I'm in. And I literally, I will stare at the cushion. I know you're there, but I am not sitting down. And, you know, I'm about 6 months into the meditation, and I haven't really hit a brick wall. It's real easy. When things are going all right, I can sit down. But it's when I've got that raw energy, I just want to punch somebody. That's when I know I need to get there. I'll do anything but that.
This is one of the dilemmas, is that often when our attention and our mindfulness and our forgiveness is most needed, it is least accessible. I don't know if the Buddha would approve of this advice, but I'll give it to you anyway. I had a teacher up in San Francisco who talked about some of this similar experience. And he said at some point, and he was in the habit of swimming in the bay, it's cold up there, and even in the winter, and they do the swim from Alcatraz in. To the, you know, with the sharks. And he turned it into a practice, and he called it the fuck you swim. And he would swim when he was in that sort of, I can't sit, but I'm, you know, filled with it, and I'm filled with this resentment, as a healthy way to express it, where I'm not hurting anybody, but I'm getting it physically out, I'm getting it out of my mind, I'm... Now, it's tricky because I do feel like there is a healthy way to express rage and to get it out like that. But we want to be careful that we're not then feeding it, right? This is the conversation that we've been having in spiritual and psychological circles about this kind of primal screaming. It is useful. So I was talking to someone the other day, and I said, okay, well, why don't you do the fuck you hike up Runyon Canyon. But on the way down, do forgiveness the whole time. Do something positive. Don't get stuck in the aversive expression of your anger. Once you've expressed it, then go to the next level. Look at what's underneath it. Okay, I'm angry because my feelings were hurt, and my feelings were hurt because this happened, and the pain takes me to this place of insecurity and terror. Whatever it brings up for me. I'll never be happy, and I'll never be loved, and I'll never be okay. And so looking at what's underneath the anger, after that healthy expression of it, might... on the hike down or on the swim back, might allow you to get to the place where you can get on your cushion and then sit with it. So, of course, there's going to be those times where sitting doesn't work so well. Do walking meditation. Do hiking meditation. Do the swim or the bike or whatever it is to get some of that energy out, but then come back when you're ready when you're exhausted and sit down and pay attention. I'm not sure the Buddha would approve of that advice, but find out for yourself if it works. Please.
I think with that young lady over there too, you've been doing it for 6 months and there's a recognition already that there's a build and that you should be doing this.
Yeah.
And that's a big step.
Yeah.
And then as the years go on, you're going to recognize that that's what you prefer to do rather than be so angry about something that's passing.
Thank you.
So maybe last comment or question.
It seems like every time I get started up the mountain, the universe will conspire to like have a trap for me. Fall back down.
I think that this is an important comment, and I didn't even go off on the yellow brick road tonight. That on this journey up the mountain or along the yellow brick road, there are the wicked witches and the flying monkeys and the poppy fields. Especially the poppy fields. There's a lot of traps. It's why the Buddha said this path goes against the stream. I don't know why I have so many analogies tonight, but I was just thinking about the stream like in the game Frogger. Where you have to not only get across the road, but then you have to like get on the logs that are going upstream and jump from log to log. But there's always something trying to get you off of your forward motion up the path.
Video game?
Yeah, it's a, I think an old, like, 80s video game.
Vintage video.
Atari.
Yeah. Yeah.
That it is against the stream. And that the stream is always going to be throwing something at you. At one point, Buddhism is called the middle path. At one point, the Buddha said, you know, this middle path that will lead to true happiness is one that leads between the two dead ends. And he said, we have one dead end that promises happiness, which is the world. The material world, which promises happiness. And does never, ever delivers it. Dead end, the material world for happiness. He said, the other dead end, religion. Which also promises happiness. In critiquing the sort of blind faith type of that most people have in religion, he said, one time critiquing prayer, he said, it's like you're on this side of the river and you're praying to the other side of the river. Hey, other side, come here. Other side of the river, come over here. It's never going to work. You got to get your ass in the water and swim. But most religion says if you just ask, the other side will come to you. Dead end that type of blind, delusional faith. That type of external magic thinking. Dead end. Action will end suffering in your life. Doing the work. Getting in the water, swimming across, will get you to the other side. So I know that that's not, I'm just normalizing your experience. We all have that experience. He said, when you start the path, it seems like there's all of these good excuses, all of these traps, all of these, the new relationship. Now, I don't need to meditate. I'll be so happy now. Taking refuge in your own commitment to persevere. As you maybe can tell if you come regularly, I'm really now into this 1%. And deciding if you really want to be 1%. Are you really committed? Do you really want to say, I'm going to spend my life's energy awakening? And of course, the other piece is that this journey, we didn't even get into it tonight, but that this journey of awakening, of happiness, is not just for ourselves, but for the benefit of all living beings. Can I end suffering in myself? Can I uncover happiness in myself so that I may be an inspiration and an example and an encouragement and a support for everyone. May I take this journey not just for my self-help, but for an altruistic offering to my friends, to my family, to my culture, to this world. Only if we persevere, only if we continue. These are some of my thoughts. Don't believe me. Don't take my word for any of this, but find out for yourself what's true in your own experiments, in your own hiking and digging and buns of stealing and froggering, and find out for yourself what's true. These are some of my thoughts inspired by Buddhist teachings. Gathering any merit that may have been created in this discussion, and just sitting for a moment with your own commitment. And asking yourself, am I in it to win it? That's a traditional Buddhist question. Many goodness that comes from our practice be shared in all directions with all living beings in existence.
You have just listened to a podcast from Against the Stream Buddhist Meditation Society. If you'd like to make a contribution to help support these teachings, please visit againstthestream.org.